My home group meets at the NABA Club in Atlanta, and I was there maybe about 4 or so years ago. I was, you know, walking to my car, and I saw this young lady sitting on the curb, smoking a cigarette, looking pretty tense and uptight, and I introduced myself, and it was Kimya, and we became fast friends, and then about a year and a half ago, and I watched her grow in recovery, and she has an amazing story, amazing personality, and then about a year and a half ago, I found out that she was between sponsors, and I scooped her up, and we've been inseparable ever since, and I have the best seat in the house. I get the privilege of watching God change her, and I'm sure you're going to feel the same way after she tells her story, and with that, I give you Kimya.
So I am Kimya. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Kimya.
And my sobriety date is October 18th, 2012. So I have not told my story in a long time. I think the last time I told my story, I was in a different state. So it was a lot calmer because I knew I wouldn't have to see the people again. So since I know most of you, I got a little bit of the jitters, but I think this is going to be very smooth. So I want to kind of start out and talk about what happened, what it was like, but I don't want to spend too much time there. I really want to get into, you know, how I came into recovery and what my life has been like since. So I'll kind of start at the beginning. Have I missed anything? I gave you my sobriety tape. You know my name. Okay. I was born here, actually, in Georgia, down south, in a place, a little place called Fayetteville, Georgia, if any of you know it. I was one of two siblings. I had a younger sister who was 15 months my junior. So we were very, very close in age. And I was born to a regular, not one of us mom, and then a dad who was an addict. Now, I didn't know that. I didn't come to know that until later on in my childhood. But when I think about what I was like as a child, I certainly had an incredible, incredible childhood. My sister and I were provided everything that we could ever want. We were offered opportunities to do everything that, that we wanted to do. But still, somehow, in being an alcoholic who hadn't learned to drink yet, had all the characteristics, all the symptoms. So super, super selfish, very self-absorbed. They would say I had ADD, but not like attention deficit disorder where I couldn't pay attention, but if people didn't pay attention to me, it was an issue. So like I had that, I was super impatient, I was controlling, and I was really bogged down by like the sense of like insecurity and very, very low self-esteem. And I think the book talks about some of the defects that we develop are in response. You know, they're trying to protect us. And so I think at the time, at a very young age, I learned to kind of wield control over other people, especially my sister and other children maybe who weren't as strong-willed or as self-absorbed as I was. I also learned to be very vengeful and very spiteful. Didn't like to let things go, so I knew how to hold on to a resentment. And an example of that is maybe around the age of 10, I learned that if my sister or my mom did something that I did not like, I would either go into their closet and cut small holes into their clothing that they would find later on, or I would just like put little drops of bleach, you know, very, very subtle, but things that they would find out later on and say, Kimya, did you do this? And I would be like, absolutely, I can't even believe you would accuse me of something like that. But just like all of these things, just kind of just red flags for anybody who knew the characteristics of like what an alcoholic is. And later on, I think I also kind of morphed into that mean girl character. I don't know if you guys have seen that movie, but those girls were nothing compared to the crew that I ran with. And that's something that came up much later on when I discovered I had this problem with alcoholism, because I was downright nasty to people. And again, it was that defense mechanism of I need to figure out a way to cover up the fact that I feel so bad about myself and I feel so low. And so the way to do that is to make someone else feel lower. I can push somebody else down. So that was big. And honestly, I don't want to give you examples of exactly how I was mean, but I'll give you this one very telling example. when I was in high school, the Columbine tragedy had happened when I was maybe a sophomore. And I remember around the time everybody was, you know, very much on the lookout for, you know, anybody who looks, you know, who's showing characteristics of being off or maybe, you know, getting revenge on someone. And so there was a rumor floating around at our school that someone had made a list. And I came home and I said, oh my God, Mom, you're not going to believe. They say there's a list out there of somebody, you know, people they want to kill at the school. And she said, are you on it? And I was like, ouch. But that's the kind of person I was. Even my mom, you know, I'm sure she loved me to death, but she also knew this is the daughter I've been given, and she's not a nice person. So fast forward, I think I was probably maybe in middle school when I discovered that my father had this disease. He had been gone on a retreat or a business trip to Dallas for a couple of weeks. And finally, you know, he came home and my mom sat me and my sister down and my dad was there. And she said, tell me what you think about when you hear the word addict or alcoholic. And this is like the first time, this is like blowing me away. I had no idea. My dad never, I've never seen my dad drunk or under the influence. So this was just kind of like out of left field. And, you know, I wanted to come up with a smart answer, you know, so I said, someone who's out of control, you know, and so she said, oh, you know, that's a very good answer. And so they kind of went through and this is what's happened to your dad and he's very sick and, you know, he's getting help. And then I think I was just so into Kimya's world and nothing else went on that that kind of breezed over me and I never really thought twice about it again. And eventually they did separate. So I do remember that, but I cannot tell. I mean, I was so self-absorbed that a lot of things I just don't remember either because I just was so interested in what was going on in my own life that I really just didn't have time or the interest to concern myself with what was going on. I'm like the antithesis of someone who's codependent. I care too much about myself to be codependent, honestly. And that's being honest. And that's something that obviously coming into the program that I've been able to work on. So I had a later drinking career, if you can call it that, relatively late. So I actually didn't have my first drink until I was on my senior trip for high school. We went to Cancun. And this was like around the time where MTV Spring Break and Carmen Electra and like that whole scene was going. So I was like, I'm going to go to Cancun. And I think I was 16 at the time and there was no drinking age in Mexico. And I was like, and I'm going to get MTV Spring Break wasted. And I did. And I was like, okay, now I see what all the fuss is about. This is kind of cool. You know, I was dancing on tables and really, you know, all my inhibitions kind of flew away. And I was like, this is the life. Like, this is what college is going to be all about. And I'm going to tear it up at college. And so I ended up, I think before this, getting into a school that I didn't really feel like I belonged to. I got into Emory. I wasn't a bad student, but I did not consider myself to be like cream of the crop. So when I got in, I was like, this is a great opportunity. I definitely should take it. And before I went, I started to kind of experience anxiety. Anxiety because I was like, I'm going to be going to this school. There's all these rich kids. There's all these kids that are really smart who really belong there. And then there's me. You know, I'm not going to fit in. And how am I going to compete academically? And I don't know how this is all going to work out. But I went there and discovered, you know, the joys of what college is really all about, which is the social scene and the drinking and, you know, experimenting with different drugs. And I tried them all. And while at the same time, I think, and this is a trend that remained throughout my drinking career, is that mask that they talk about in the book. So, you know, the alcoholic wears a mask, you know, to his friends and to his employer, he's one way. And then, you know, there's this wild child underneath it. And so, you know, I wanted to keep my priorities straight. And so I would immediately from class, go to the library, get all my work done, do all my studying, hours and hours and hours. And that left me with the rest of the night to just rip and run and get wasted. So that at least if I had taken care of my responsibilities, I didn't feel like, you know, I was, that I had a problem. You know, and that continued for a while. But college was, it was just weird. We had, and this just goes to show how far and how quickly I adapted into the disease. There was a club on campus. It was an underground club. It was called Triangle L. it was illegal to be in the club in the county because of things that had happened with the club in the past. And it was essentially like this thing that you got hazed into. But it was specifically for like druggies and alcoholics. That's all I can, that's, no one would ever say that at the time, but it was the people who liked to party. And so one day they had what they called mass. And mass had nothing to do with church religion. Mass was where you went into like the cemetery and they would have, you know, like a bag of joints and they'd have handles of alcohol and they would, you know, pass this around and everybody would get wasted. And then they would tap in a new member of this Triangle L Club. And so I got tapped in one night. They pushed me to my knees in the muddy grass, whatever it was. And then they shoved a bottle of Captain Morgan's. It was a handle. So you had to drink that. So you're just puking up and you have to smoke they have a bong out there and then you smoke so many joints and then they're feeding you this grog. And it's just a mess. It's a terrible, like horrible experience. Half of what is going in is just coming out. And then I got a hat and that hat, and I think my mom threw it away, but it read, my maiden last name was Coker, and it said Toker Coker. So now I had like this nickname and this identity, and this was like a rite of passage. Like I was like, nah, this is cool. Like I'd rather be in this than anything else. But at the same time, I'm in this, you know, underground club. You're not supposed to be in it or have any paraphernalia. On the other side, I'm on the dean's list. I had been selected by the dean to be on the conduct board, which is where people come before this board of students. There were like six of us, and they would get caught for drinking in their rooms. One time, some guy pulled a gun on somebody. It was almost always drugs and alcohol related, and you decided their fate, whether or not they get to stay in school or they are expelled and pushed out, and this was me, and that's what I was tapped to do. I was a senator. I mean, it was all about the more I can do, you know, to be active and to do all the right things and, you know, to be involved is taking away from the fact that I'm starting to develop a drug habit and an alcohol problem. So it was around this time that I started, I think the first visible signs of me having a drug problem became apparent. So my parents came out to the school, and I must have lost like 30 pounds, which doesn't seem like a lot, but it was a lot for the size I was at the time. And I remember my sister coming to school and being like, oh my God, mom, she's on drugs. Like, you can't tell. Like, it was just, you know, and I was oblivious. And I remember my dad, remember now, my dad has this disease. And I was like, daddy, I need some money. You know what I mean? Like, it's time to pay the piper. You know, I'm here, I'm getting an education. It's time for you to give me some money for whatever it was. My dad was like, no, we're not going to do that. And I remember him saying to my mom, like under his breath, see, this is what she wants us to do. You know, it was kind of like this talking about my back, but he knew what I was going to go do with that money. And my strategy at the time was they had started sending credit cards to college students and they had this thing called a cash advance. And I learned about that and I was like, oh my God, free money. Like, how does nobody else know about this awesome program? So I was able to pay for drugs with that, with like the allowance that my parents, you know, routinely gave me. And so that went on and on and on. And finally, college was over. I graduated and now it was time to enter the real world. I knew from the age of five I wanted to be an attorney. And so I was like, God, you know, undergrad was really fun. I feel like law school is going to be a lot of work. So I was like, but I still want to do it, you know, because my whole thing in what I wanted to be, the person I wanted to be seen as, was somebody who was important, powerful, you know, had a lot of money, had the right connections. It was all about that image. And being an attorney kind of fed into that. And so I took that summer, did you know, a lot of drinking and using, and then like it was 2 weeks before the LSAT and I was like, shit, I need to go buy a book and start studying for this. And that clearly didn't go well. And so I decided at that time, you know what, I'm going to get, you know, an internship. I'll just start, you know, I'll start out, kind of play around, see what I can come up with. And I ended up just kind of falling into the technology space and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. It was super laid back. It was like this kind of .com era. So there was a lot of like startups, you know, coming up every day, and the culture was very much like work hard, play hard. And I was like, oh, this is the life. And I got to travel all over the place, and I was making good money, and it was encouraged. Like, I mean, I remember part of my job was like throwing these cocktail parties for partners, like, you know, so, I mean, it was just, you know, we would have, you know, they'd say, Kimya, go to the store and get, you know, 6 bottles of this and 10 bottles of that. And so I would get it, and I'd be like, 6 for you and 1 for me. And you know what I mean? It just kind of fueled everything. And I think at this time I was still kind of weekend warrior. I was trying to play the role of like, I'm going to be a young professional. I'm going to be responsible. And then only on the weekends will I go and really do my dirt. And so over time, obviously the disease progressed and it became less about the weekend and more about how do I sneak some of this into my actual week? Because I'm needing more than just Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then do it all over again. So the habit is starting to form a little bit more where it's becoming not as important yet, but it's starting to compete with the work life and with everything else that's going on. So it's becoming a larger part of my life. And it was, I think I was probably about 25, still great at my job and what I did, but very much still, you know, a regular drug user and alcoholic. And my dad came to my house one day, and he, I think, attempted to perform like an intervention on me, and it failed. You know, and he said, I'm going to tell you, he said, I just want to tell you. And he wasn't like that heavy-handed, like he clearly had read the book. How do you approach an alcoholic? You tell them what it was like for you. You don't come and say, you got to do this. And he said, I just want to tell you what it was like for me. And he said, it is a living hell. And I don't want you to have to go down that path. And he said, what's going to happen? He said, I'm telling you as sure as day, this is what happened to me is you're having fun. You're young. You know, it's all about the party and you've got this great life. He said, but what's going to happen is it's going to come a day when you want to stop and you won't be able to. I couldn't fathom that. It didn't, that did not connect with me because I have control, right? When you want to stop something, you stop. That was my, you know, my thought. And he said, when this happened to me, I said to myself, my mind's too strong for that. Like, I'm too smart. Like, how could you not stop? And he said, but it is a living hell. I'm telling you now. So that was his warning. And he said, hands off. You know, that was it. And it was a great approach because I think he knew enough about alcoholism to know that, like, that story wasn't going to just stop me in my tracks and say, you know what, white lightning experience, I'm done. But he wanted to plant the seed. And the seed had been planted, whether I knew it or not at the time. So eventually, as time goes on, I start to bring back in some of the outside issues in addition to the alcohol. Alcohol was always a constant, but it wasn't always enough for me. I needed to like mix it with something. I wanted like the Mexican restaurant, there's a combination platter. And so I wanted a little bit of like, you know, this and a little bit of that. And then the alcohol just constantly throughout. So there were things that kept me up. There were things that kept me mellow. Things that made me feel like the alcohol didn't impact me enough. It kept me like, you know, even. So, I started around this time maybe thinking I wanted to stop. Like, I'm going to be 30 soon. And I was like, and at 30, I really want to, like, not be a pothead and, like, you know, the same persona. I really want to, I'm going to want to have kids and get married. And so I need to take on, like, a different persona. And at this time, a lot of my friends from college were starting to get married. And they were starting to talk about having kids. And here I am showing up to their house, you know, with like, you know, bags of goodies and things like that. And it was like everybody else was starting to grow up. And here I was like, shit, I'm still back, you know. And that's really like underneath it what made me want to stop. I started seeing people living their lives. Like it was almost like that looking from the outside in. Like I would walk around my neighborhood and like, I wasn't being a peeping Tom, but like literally just looking, you know, gazing past a window and wondering what the life of that person was like. Like somebody who was in there who wasn't like sitting, you know, fiending for drugs or sitting there, you know, getting drunk on alcohol and having to have it. And I started thinking like, God, I really would love to have what they have. And so now the idea is starting to be planted that I might have a problem. And And that was scary for me because that just did not fit the image that I wanted to have, right? Is this uber successful young professional who's got it all together and who's got this great lifestyle and who's responsible and who's an adult. And it didn't fit with any of that. And so I started on this road of, I'm going to figure out like how to beat this thing. I went on what I would like to call a champagne diet for about a month. Because I was like, if I just drink champagne, surely I'm going to run out of money. Like, this will do it. I did that for a while. I tried giving up, like, every other substance except for this. You know, I'll just do this. And it was like, I'll just drink because that's legal. You know, at least I can do that. And then I think around this time, I discovered the thing that, along with alcohol, licked me good. I know this is singleness of purpose. I'll just throw it. It was a medicinal, a pharmaceutical cure. And so began mixing that with the alcohol, and my fall when I started that was so much faster when it was combined with the alcohol. So, it was not long before I was doctor shopping to get what I needed. It was not long before I actually had two grandparents die within 6 months of each other. And so obviously as they were dying, you know, they're on their deathbeds and they're kind of at home and they're making them comfortable. And there is tons of medicine around. And I took every opportunity standing beside my dying grandparents' bed to get what I needed. I also had a neighbor at the time, and this neighbor and I would get together and we would drink wine and, you know, have fun after work. And she, you know, had some things prescribed to her. And at the time, our neighborhood, we had digital door locks. And so you just use a code to get in. There was no key. And I knew hers and she knew mine. And so I started to say, okay, this is the last. Once I'm done with this stash and I'm done with this bottle, I'm done. And tomorrow I'm going to stop. And it was not happening. I would wake up in the morning, and I finally understand what, I think it was Bill who talks about waking up and, like, the insanity was upon him almost immediately. I would think, how am I going to get through a day at work without something? Like, there's no, you know what, I just got to get something for this morning, and then this afternoon, I'll stop. And so I started using her door code to access her house, and taking her medication to give me something in the morning. That's how the insanity, I was desperate, that desperate. And this was a good friend of mine. And that was insane, but it gets crazier. She came over to my house one afternoon, which was normal. And she said, Kimya, I've got to tell you something. And I said, okay, come in, sit down. She said, I discovered that somebody's been breaking into my house and stealing my medicine. My heart stops. But in my mind, the good alcoholic and liar I am is like, keep your cool, get ready to think of a lie, right? You can come up with a good story. And she said, today I parked on the backside of my house so they wouldn't know I was there. She said, and I heard someone punching the numbers into my door. And she said, and I opened the door and the guy who lives downstairs was standing there. Whew. I'm like, all right, good. And I said, Amanda, I cannot believe it. I said, oh my God, you must feel so violated. I said, we need to call the cops right now, you know? And so I went into this whole process of, I'm going to help you avenge, you know, what this guy has done to you. This is so horrible. This man is sick. Who could do something like this? Like, I can't believe it. I went with her to the cops, helped her write a police report, you know, gave her tips on how she should. This is self-defense, and, you know, I'm going to give you my stun gun, because if this guy ever comes, you know, you don't know what he's capable of if he would break into your home. And I mean, this was like, I mean, I should have won an Academy Award for the acting. But that's the insanity, was that he has a problem, right? He must be crazy, but not me. So at this point, I'm sure I'm an alcoholic. I'm a drug addict. Like, I remember sitting on my stairs and smoking cigarettes and being like, I'm a junkie. There's no hiding it. I accept it. Like, it's everything my dad said would happen has happened. And I want to stop so bad and I can't. And so around this time, you guys have probably seen these commercials. They come on late at night And it's like a commercial that says, you know, are you addicted to drugs and alcohol? Well, there's a cure. And there's, you know, these beautiful vistas and this Malibu mansion, and they've got a beach. And they say, no, it's a cure. Like, no 12-step programs, you know, none of that, you know, none of that bullshit. You just, you know, this is the cure. It's going to cure the underlying cause of your illness, and you'll never, ever think about drinking or doing drugs again. And I was like, see, that's what I need. That's what I need right there. So I went to the Barnes, started going to the Barnes & Noble right after work, and reading this book, The Alcoholism and Addiction Cure. And it's actually written by like a father and son team that run a treatment center out in Malibu. And so I start reading this and I'm like, oh my God, this is, now I get it. Self-knowledge, that'll do it, right? So now I know, all right, I have this thing. They've talked about this holistic program. I need to go get some acupuncture. I need to start doing yoga. I should go to an organic diet. There were all of these things that I could do to cure myself. And once I'm cured, it's done. I'll never have to go to a 12-step meeting, never identify myself as an alcoholic. I was like, this is perfect. Why don't most people do this? And if I can't get through it, I'll go to Malibu, you know, and I'll get the, you know, there'll be the chefs and the yoga and all that stuff. And that'll be a nice vacation. And then I'll be cured. And so I did that. And also around this time, I started convincing myself that what I really needed, like, was to do my own detox program, because it was the alcohol that was like still inside me and the residue of all those drugs. I just needed to flush that out and like get a clean start. And that was going to cure me. So I don't know if you guys have heard of the Master Cleanse. But the Master Cleanse is basically, I don't know what, you can call it a fad diet. 14 days, you don't eat anything. You only are allowed to drink a solution of maple syrup, organic lemons, cayenne pepper, and water. And so I was walking around my office with this jug of like what looked to be, I don't even know. It's not a pretty color. It's a dingy brown. And I would drink this, and by day four, I'd be like, man, I feel amazing. Why do people, you know, I've got so much more willpower than the person who needs to go to like rehab and detox, because I'm doing it on my own. And so I did that a few times, because that was going to be the solution for me, is I just got to detox. And after that, I'm going to feel so good. I'm not going to want the drugs again. Anything but having to go to a meeting and be like, my name is so-and-so and I'm an alcoholic. So, it wasn't working. Like what was happening is in the beginning, I might stay off, you know, I might be clean for like maybe a month. And then I'd be like, wait, what am I doing? I can have at least a little bit of this or a little bit of that. And it would be full swing again. And so it was getting closer and closer between the times where I would not eat for 14 days and when I would go back out. And I was like, this is not good. I'm praying, you know, God, just take this away. I know you can work miracles. I had a relationship with God, you know, grew up in the church. So I'm like, just take it away. Cause what I want is for it to just be gone. Miraculous. I wake up one morning, it's gone. I don't want to do work. I just want it to be gone. And if God can do that, now I'm praying to him, just take it away. So towards the end, I remember this was like the last week of my drinking. I'm praying every day. I'm doing like juice fast during the day. Just God, please take this away. You know, I just want everything to go away. And we had a partner coming in town. And so he reached out to me and they said, Kimia, can you take this guy out? You know, he really likes you. Can you, you know, just take him out, show him a good time. I said, okay, fine. But before I went, I was like, God, I really need something. Like I'm feeling anxious, and I need something to take the edge off. So I went over to my neighbor, borrowed some stuff from her, and decided I'm just going to have a couple glasses of wine and then I will go, I'll go back home. And the combination of whatever it is I took and the amount of alcohol that I took in, I ended up in a blackout. Not for long, but I vaguely remember being in this guy's room, hotel room, and then I remember walking out to get in my car. This is at like the St. Regis in Buckhead, and I don't know how they let me get in this car to drive. My house is like 2 miles from there. So I get in the car, I'm like, can I get home, you know, take a really good sleep. I've got an executive breakfast I have to be at in the morning. And so I look in the rearview mirror and I see these blue lights, and the thought in my head is like, oh God, I now have to deal with this before I go home, you know, because I'm going to go home after this. And so the cop pulls me over. Now, I've had easily 2.5, probably at least 2 bottles of wine by myself, in addition to like all the things that I drank with him. And so I'm sure as soon as I roll down the window, he can smell it. I'm sure my eyes are bloodshot. He says, have you been drinking? I give him the magic number, only 2, right? Just 2. I didn't say glasses. I probably in my head was thinking bottles. But he said, well, can you step out of the car? And when he asked me to do that, in my mind, I stepped out. But what really happened on the camera was that I kind of fell out of the car. And I remember being shocked when he was like, you're going to jail. No, I know what it was. He said, I think, you know, you're drunk. I'm gonna need you to do a breathalyzer. I said, I'm not doing that. I know my rights. I don't have to do that. My sister's an attorney, because I wasn't. And he said, all right, well, then I'm going to take you to jail. And I said, that's fine. I'm still not going to blow. And then I started, I don't know what it was I was saying to him, but it was very much from a place of superiority. And that's important later on. So I get to jail, and I'm still very much, not in a blackout anymore, but still very inebriated. And so I get there, and it's, you know, they've got me at holding. So there's, you know, prostitutes and other people who are drunk. And I'm telling, you know, the other drunk people, hey, don't blow. If they ask you to blow in that breathalyzer, I know my rights and I know the law. So this cop is just watching me sit here and just be a nuisance. And so finally it's time for me to make my phone call. And I was like, okay. Everything I've heard about jail is you have to, like, really let them know. You know, you gotta make sure that people know that you're not anybody to be messed with, right? So you got to kind of make a name for yourself. I don't know how long I'm going to be in here. And so I get my sister on the phone, and I'm like, I need you to come get me. I'm in jail. And she said, for what? And I looked around, and I was like, I killed somebody! And which is ridiculous, because I was in lockup. I was clearly drunk, you know, and just acting a fool. And so the next morning, you know, I wake up and I'm like, or I got halfway slept. She came and to get me. And so I get home. I had to like ride the MARTA train home. And my dad calls me and he's like, I'm going to come get you and we're going to go get your car out of impound and everything. He's totally calm. Like, this is nothing. And so he finally comes to get me, and I'll never forget it. We're in his car, we're driving down Cheshire Bridge, and this is like the third or fourth place that we're trying to get my car. I gotta go get the registration, I gotta do this, do that. It was a whole to do. And we're driving down Cheshire Bridge, and he says to me, and I remember like when he had picked me up, he said, so you got your first DUI. Because for him, it's like he's on number, you know, he had been on number 7 before he got clean. And by this time, he's had like 15 sobriety. And I'm like, why is he so, you know, this is not funny. This sucks. And so he said to me, he looks over at me and he said, well, do you think he might want to get some help? And immediately, like somebody says in the book, the scales fell from my eyes. I completely broke down. That, I think, was my point of surrender. I am done. I cannot do this. And only later, once I got into recovery, did I look back at that week of where I was just praying, please, God, save me, heal me. What was happening is that was divine intervention for me to get that DUI, because no consequences. I had no consequences. I had a great job. I could travel. I could do whatever I wanted. There was nothing that would have driven me to say, my life is unmanageable. Absolutely nothing. And so that night, I checked into Peachford. It was not Malibu. There was no yoga. There was no pools. There was no organic chef. And I remember thinking while I was there, like I said, had I gone to Malibu, I would have been okay going back, relapsing, you know, every couple years just to get like the vacation. There, I was like, I will never, ever darken the doors of this place again. This is horrible. So I stayed there, detoxed for like 5 days. And then afterwards, my higher power obviously was always with me, but started to just show up in miraculous ways immediately. I was worried. I'm like, it's been 5 days. My job has no idea. All they know is Kimya has been checked in for depression and maybe an eating disorder or something like that. And so, eating disorder. And so I, you know, called my boss, and I'd been talking to a woman that my dad knew in the program. Since I had gotten out of Ridgeview, and I said, I don't know what to do about my job. I said, I gotta let them know something. And I know, and everybody kept saying, whatever you put before your recovery, you will lose. And if it means you have to lose this job, you're gonna have to do it. And so she said, look, just be honest. And I was like, I really don't think this is the time to be honest. Like, I need to keep this job. I got a lifestyle and an image, you know, to uphold. And I remember I walked outside of my house and I called my boss And I said, I need to let you know, like, what's going on with me. And I just broke down again, and I said, I'm an addict. And I need to be able to take some time to do this outpatient. There's a lot of stuff going on, and I need to get this right. His response to me was, my brother's in the program. He's got 5 years. He was on crack, you know, for years and years and years. You take whatever time you need. And we'll be here to support you. And still to this day, I don't work at that company anymore. Every time I go and connect with that boss over coffee, or I've done some consulting projects for him, he asks, you know, how's everything going with that? And I've met his brother. I met his brother several years later at a party. And that was just, again, like the way that God works in situations like that, that was a God moment for sure. So let's see, what else? So at this point now I'm getting into recovery. I'm starting to go to meetings regularly. I've got a home group, and I'm like, okay, like this is, I've got some structure. As soon as I leave work, I'm going to these meetings, and I'm starting to learn what it means to pray and to surrender and let go. And I'm learning for the very first time in my life, humility and what it means to truly just be, I have no idea what I'm doing, and I need help, and I've got to lean on other people and a higher power for that. And so I was probably sober close to 6 months before I got my first sponsor. And I got her, and her approach at the time was, we are going to work steps 1 through 10 in one day. So I've heard a lot of different approaches, but she was like, that's the way my sponsor did it with me, is we like to just go straight through. And she had made the comment, you know, I'll never let a sponsor do like a 4th or 5th step alone. I want to be there with you as you write it out and as you do it. And we did that. And it was, I think I got to her apartment at maybe 8 o'clock, and we didn't finish until 10 o'clock at night, all day long of just remembering and things I hadn't thought about in years and years and years, resentments I didn't know I had, and what it really meant to be fearful. Cause I didn't understand that concept. Everybody kept talking about being in fear, and I'm like, I'm not afraid of anything. Like, I am afraid of water, I'm afraid of heights, and I'm afraid of most animals. But that was all I could think of, like, in terms of my fears. I wasn't afraid of anything. And only later on did I recognize anxiety is a type of fear. So when I was afraid that I wasn't going to get the promotion, or I was afraid that I might, you know, die, I lived in constant fear, and I never recognized it until I came into AA. And then I think I also learned forgiveness too. Like, that's a big one. I told you I was very vengeful, very spiteful, could hold a grudge, and not just hold a grudge, but I wanted to act on that. You know, I wanted to make sure I got you back. And so just really having to work on that, making a forgiveness journal, gratitude, good Lord. Like, I have a life that I still every day have to challenge myself not to say I don't deserve it. But I have been blessed in ways that I cannot imagine a person who was like what I was like could have the life I have today. It's a miracle. And I've had, you know, I've had challenges. I've had a lot of challenges. I've had other addictions crop up in place of the alcohol. The alcoholism is still there. You know, food. I love food. Shopping, you know, smoking, all these other addictions that are kind of competing. They're trying to, you know, my alcoholism is still trying to get out in some way. And I'll tell you, I still to this day have using and drinking dreams. I have them at least, I'd say a couple times a month. And what that does for me is I wake up and I feel the panic, like it happened, and I know I'm still an alcoholic because something in my subconscious is still wanting, you know, that life is still wanting those substances. And that's, I've heard a woman share in a meeting, she had 25 years and she still has drinking dreams. So it may not go away, but for me, it's a blessing because it reminds me that this disease is very much still alive and well. There is no cure. There's a solution. You know, and that's working the program every day. And you know, I mentioned challenges. I actually, I never thought I would sponsor anybody. Like, I felt like, you know, I felt like the role of a sponsor was so important to someone's life. I was like, I would never, if I was somebody, like, put my life in my hands. If it was me, like, I would not want me as a sponsor. If it, you know, they might as well just go ahead and die, you know? And that's how I felt. I was like, nobody should ever count on me for such a critical, like, role in their life. And of course, as I worked the steps and I saw the, you know, what my sponsor, like, the time that she was spending with me and everything else, that it was, you need to now go pass this on. And so I was able to sponsor and take a couple of women through the steps, which was an amazing, amazing gift. And then I had one young woman that I worked with. She was 16 at the time. Her father was also an alcoholic, and I met her one night when she came to the clubhouse, and her friend had just overdosed and died. And so a bunch of them had been spooked, and they had come to the clubhouse. They knew where to go because her dad was an alcoholic. And I met this girl, and so we connected, and shortly afterwards she went into treatment, and so we started working together. And I sensed that she wasn't ready. She's still young, and there's just, you know, even with that death, I think a lot of people still say that won't be me. You know, it's everybody else. That could happen to them, but it won't happen to me. And sure enough, about 6 months later, at the age of 16, she overdosed and passed away. And so, but again, that's a reminder, this is a fatal disease. It will kill you. 16, 50, 70, it doesn't discriminate. So just like dealing with things like that, and recognizing that this is truly a gift that I've been able to keep, because I have not, no one, you know, I certainly haven't worked a perfect program. I've made a lot of bad decisions. I think 2 weeks after I got out of rehab, I decided on Friday I was going to go to Bangkok on Sunday. So just shit like that, you know, just bad decisions. I'm going to do what I want to do. I'll work this program the way I want to work it. I'll work my program. And still God has seen fit for me to stay sober and to be able to carry the message. And about 2 years ago, I broke up with my sponsor. It really wasn't working out. And for 6 months, I decided I had this genius idea. Like, I know somebody who knows me better than anybody else. And this person is going to be, like, the best sponsor because, you know, I'm closest to them. And it's going to be super easy to work with them. And it was me. And so I sponsored myself for 6 months. And I thought it was going really well. And then I went into a meeting and I shared something. And somebody was like, are you working with a sponsor? And I said, well, right now, you know, I'm kind of taking like a hiatus, you know, from the whole external sponsor thing, you know, and I'm just kind of, you know, like, and I, you know, I want to make sure I make the right decision, you know, because it's a big decision and I need to make sure I meet the right person. I haven't met the right person yet. And so I took some suggestions because many people were like, you really need to get a sponsor. Like, it's not working. You think it's working. It's not. And so I went in search of this woman that I was the first person to reach out to me when I went to NABA. And I was like, I had been wanting to ask this woman to be my sponsor for years. But it was like that insecurity came back of like, well, she's going to say no. She's got enough sponsors. She's not going to have time. She's not going to want to work with you. And so finally I had to, using that humility, go to this meeting where I knew she would be at. And then, you know, I raised my hand to share and it probably had nothing to do with the topic. And I was like, I've been sponsoring myself, you know, and here's how it's going. And I probably should get a sponsor. Okay, the end. Thanks for letting me share. And that was meant to get her, you know, get her attention. And she came to stand next to me during the Lord's Prayer and grabbed my hand and gave me that shake like, all right, it's on. And since then, I have just like been on fire. And that's to me, like when I say my prayers at night, you know, I thank God for putting people in my path, because God works through people. You know, and my higher power comes in many different forms of the different people that I see and touch throughout the day. And so, you know, I thank God, like, thank God I have this sponsor who is living by example. You know, someone that I can really look to and say, this is how you work a program, and this is how you attain selflessness, you know, and this is how you really be of service to someone without wanting anything in return. And that's just really set like my sobriety on fire. It's made me made me want to be more involved, and made me want to be of service, like, and really give back. And the other cool thing is, it is amazing to me, like, anywhere you go in the world, there's these AA meetings. And wherever you go in the world, there's always an English-speaking meeting. So I've been AA meetings all over the world. And I never could travel without having something, some kind of substance. And I've traveled more in the last 4.5 years, I think, than I traveled probably my entire life before then. And almost every city I've been to meetings. I mean, I've been, you know, and I went to a meeting last year in an abandoned monastery like thing in Thailand. There were two people at the meeting, but this guy came and picked me up. And this is an English speaking meeting. This guy, you know, I called him. I said, I'm a friend of Bill, and I see you guys are having the meeting. And he was like, well, it might just be me, but I'll come pick you up. And it's like that's the connection. Anywhere you go, there is a group of people who get you, who are ready to connect with you and make sure you get what you need while you're there. You know, because sometimes that can be dangerous, is you get out of your element and you're in another place and you're traveling, and it can be tempting, you know, sometimes to pick up. So the other thing that happened is I met my husband in AA, which does not happen to a lot of people. And it again was a very much a God thing, because I would have never been ready for the man that my husband is. That was not the kind of person that I dated or dealt with, because I was a sick individual. And I would have never been able to appreciate the man that he is. He'll have 11 years in July. And that was a God thing, is that God did not deliver to me, you know, the one, you know, my soulmate, until I had done some work on myself and it required this program. If I was never an alcoholic, I would never do any kind of inward reflection. I would just keep being a selfish, you know, mean girl, vengeful, spiteful. Those things would be fine, because I would be like, I don't have any problems, you know, but instead God placed this, like, you know, seemingly insurmountable obstacle in front of me and force me to deal with it. It wasn't, I'm just going to remove it, you know, and let you kind of walk over it. You're going to have to walk through it, and you're going to have to do the work. And I think that that's the blessing, you know, when you hear people say, oh, well, I'm grateful to be an alcoholic. For me, it's, you know, I feel like this is making me like the person that my higher power wants me to be, because I would not do this work otherwise. There would be no program of action, no spiritual. I'd go to church. I'm spiritual enough. That's what I thought, you know. And I think the biggest thing that's come out of my recovery is a true relationship with God. I think before I did, you know, I went through the motions. I went to church, you know, I prayed mostly for the things I wanted. I wanted more of this and less of that. And now I pray, make sure that most of my prayer is for other people. Is, God, what is your will for me? Not is, what do I want to do next and how can you support me in doing that? And I think that's been the biggest transformation. I work with many outside people. I admit I need help. So I work with a lot of people, not just a sponsor. I have a life coach who suggested that I ask my mom. We were doing this exercise and trying to kind of uncover some of the things that are still like some residual stuff from my childhood. And asked, you know, recommended that I ask my mom what she was most proud of me for. And I was like, oh, God, she'll say getting clean, like getting off that stuff, right? That's what I'm thinking. And I asked her, and she said, it would be your relationship with God. And I was like, oh, my God. I never expected that would be her answer. So I don't know. I have no idea what time it is. I don't know who's phone this. Ooh, good job. So it's 9:50. I feel like I hit all the talking points on my bulleted list. I don't know. I owe my life to this program. And I get that it is a gift, and I do not take it for granted. And I try as much as I can to remember why I'm still sober today. And that's so I can carry the message. And so I can be of service to someone who needs to hear it. And who needs that experience, strength, and hope. So with that, I was going to be like, are there any questions? I'm so used to being in meetings all day that I always have to pause and say, all right, what's the next step? That's my story. I'm sticking to it. Thank you guys for being here and listening.